So I wanted to just point out that in the aggregate, if you're looking at the different responses that companies have to problems, and especially when it comes to responding to government pressure over such problems, I'm not sure that you could have a worse response than generating the proof of exactly the kind of thing people are worried about in response to any kind of potential legislation. And I say that by way of saying, whoever at TikTok had the bright idea of having all a bunch of teenagers across the country call their congressmen, call their senators, and threaten them with death, assassination, and suicide in response to the potential of a forced sale of TikTok from ByteDance. That person is an absolute idiot. And I'm sure that it is more than one person, but whoever it is, I mean, I cannot think of a worse possible response than something that just completely vindicates the fears of everybody who's been talking about your business and what it could potentially do to America's youth.
Well, and you know what else? If there's one thing that politicians love more than a flood of constituent calls, it's when all of those calls are from non-voters. That's their favorite.
Yeah, this moment was really missing, at least so far, its champion. If you all remember a number of years ago, yeah, I guess it wasn't maybe 4 or 5 years ago, when I can't remember if it was school or something like that, brought in a bunch of like middle school age kids to lecture Dianne Feinstein on
Yes.
climate change and how the world was going to end. And she just absolutely went to town on them, and the kids are looking absolutely shell-shocked. And as a career Republican, I was just like saying, like, go on, Queen. I think this
If
was a
you
real opportunity for somebody.
have not seen Cecily Strong's SNL sketch as Dianne Feinstein responding to the kids, do yourself a favor and Google it right now. Just pause the podcast, watch it. It's absolutely hilarious, and it's wonderful, every little bit of it. So
That was a great turned out that was a great like swan song last act in public life. That
yes,
was a great
absolutely.
moment.
Well, I've been around for a lot longer than you, and I know a lot more than you too. So, well, I guess we're all going
You
to
know what you know what you said though, that like to me is real about this TikTok thing. I think that there's some nuance on the policy question. There's some nuance, but I think at the end of the day, don't overthink the nuance and just, ban the Chinese communist propaganda mass surveillance app in the US that's brainwashing our kids. And it's not even a ban. I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But anyway, but the one thing that you said that I think is real is the people who are claiming that there's just going to be like a rash of we'll sanitize it and say self-harm among teenagers if this app gets banned. And there's just we know that there's a tactic among certain social movements of threatening, to hurt themselves if they don't get their way. And it struck me as a sickly, darkly funny thought that like in 5 or 10 years it's just going to become completely routine to threaten to harm yourself to get what you want. It's
Well,
like
but this is but my response to that was, it felt like, were these people paying attention after the Tom Cotton op-ed? Did they learn it from watching the New York Times? I learned this from Taylor Lorenz.
yes, but
It works. So no,
I mean, the extension of this into everything is just be incredible. Like, hey, we need to, forget marijuana. Let's legalize cocaine. And if you don't, I'm going to kill myself. Like, where does it stop?
Yeah, no, I just
Yeah, can I borrow a dollar? I'll cut myself
yeah, no,
if I
it's
can't. I mean.
look, I think that this is, an area of policy where you can have legitimate arguments about free speech issues and about a number of different things that, I would be happy, to have a debate with someone who's in the Thomas Massey, Rand Paul school of like that, they've been defending the idea that this is something that should be allowed to exist for quite a while with a reasoned philosophical sort of backing to it. But this knee-jerk response that TikTok precipitated is the exact opposite of that. Instead, what they've basically done is say, it's as if, you know, this the whole thing is being run by some backwards Mongolian. We will turn your children against you, and they will rebel against you, and we will turn them, and you will be afraid. It's like, no, guys, that's not going to be the way this works out for you. I don't know whose idea it was, but I just think it's very it's amusing on a level, because when you have just sort of teenagers railing against something and screaming about something, and Dan, to your point, they can't even vote. You know, there was some of the quotes that were, you know, showing up in some of the coverage of this included them saying, you know, I just learned what a member of Congress was today because of TikTok, you know, and that kind of thing. And
But
it's
also, yeah, but also, yeah, exactly. But also, I get all my news from TikTok. You know, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what a member. I don't know what Congress is. I don't know how many houses there are in it. But I get all my information from TikTok.
Look, I mean, it was, you know, digital, but you know, slightly more analog than this when I was up there and working in Congress. And you know, you'd get these patch through calls from, you know, sort of these, you know, AstroTurf organizations, and people would, you know, be like, hey, the guy that called me said I should tell you I'm, you know, mad about, you know, whatever it was. And you're like, okay, you know, great. Like, do you even live in this state? Oh, no. I'm like, all right, cool. So I mean, this seems like an extension of that, but I think we've learned something really valuable in all of this is that whoever, you know, can take credit for this within TikTok, that person should become president because they have managed to unify Democrats and Republicans in Congress in a way we have not seen in a long time.
That is great. That is a great lesson, John. You are correct. This is Thunderdome, and we have many things to talk about. Given that we had to take a week off because of me suffering once again from the virus of unknown origin, we otherwise would have had a reaction to both Super Tuesday and to the State of the Union within a week. Now it's been 2 weeks since a speech the president gave in front of the Congress, and it was pronounced to be a rousing, amazing success universally by the corporate media, including, you know, comments saying that, you know, it was the greatest address that he'd ever given. Comparisons lodged by Joe Scarborough, you know, someone who's kind of become the Biden whisperer, that comparisons to Joe Frazier knocking out the Republicans and that kind of thing. Well, we are 2 weeks out from it, and the RCP average has moved 0.3 points in Trump's direction since Joe Biden gave the State of the Union, and the initial voter reaction to it has essentially been nil. Gentlemen, do you think that this effort on the part of Biden to give the kind of partisan State of the Union that he gave, and I think it's undeniable that it was a very partisan speech, and not the kind of, you know, olive branch speech that he could potentially have given to try to like reach out to Nikki Haley voters or something like that. Do you think that that gambit of sort of doubling down and trying to unite his base is one that worked, and will, and maybe it, you know, it won't matter, but one that at least staunched any kind of losses that he might have had over things like Gaza and some of his other decisions?
I mean, it seems like the Democrats, you know, at least in the online thing, and let me start with the caveat that like 300 million Americans, I didn't really watch it. I mean, I watched the first 15 minutes, but you know, I think that there was nothing going to be
So you
really.
watched the most partisan part of the speech, basically. I mean,
Yes,
that was
yes.
that he opened the thing that, to be honest, just as a speechwriter, the thing that was so shocking to me about it as a former speechwriter was that I would have opened with the olive branch and then gotten increasingly partisan, basically understanding that like the Democrats, the most dedicated Democrats, are going to stick around and watch most of the speech, but the first 15 minutes will probably be seen by more people. And so you lead with the olive branch, and then you turn into the partisan as the speech goes on, kind of escalating that as fewer people are watching, but it's more and more of a Democrat audience. That's
Yeah,
just
I
my
think that
two
would have been
cents.
good. I think that's correct in terms of speechcraft and messaging, but it seems like that the theory of both campaigns at this point is really to placate you know, your sort of most you know, ideological voters. And you know, the concern is, you know, again, to go back to the The Eric Adams, and I realize he's a challenged figure now for a lot of reasons, but his sort of thing about, worrying more about people on Social Security than on social media. But it seems like that, basically every campaign that has been more worried about social media than, actual voters in the last few years seems like it has not gone well. I mean, I think that the early days of the DeSantis campaign are like, and again, that might have always been an unwinnable race. And we've talked about that in the past, but I think you're right, but they seem to be more concerned about, and I think that they're, it seems like that, let's take the, sort of the Gaza stuff. They seem to have, at least from the outside, a very static view of things of like, okay, let's say things about, the Israelis going too far, or we're going to try to like otherize Netanyahu or what have you. And like, that's going to help us in Dearborn. But then they don't seem to think that there's going to be any sort of reaction from voters in other states that are like, hey, terrorism is bad, or that you have, Jewish Americans now, legitimately feeling scared or threatened in a way that I think is pretty novel and sad in the United States, with just this wave of anti-Semitism. I think it kind of goes back to the Democrats' really inability in the last few years to, that they sort of both sides stuff. Well, anti-Semitism is bad, but Islamophobia is bad too. Like, sure, I would stipulate that both of those statements are correct, but that we really need to focus on one when it's, it's one set of people that have been really victimized and othered in a mass scale in the last, number of months. Ben, I think what we saw here was just sort of, they were looking to show an adrenaline hit on the president to his base to say, he's still got the gas left in the tank. To do this, the fact that they still need to do that, 8 months out from election day, I think is a little concerning for them. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't feel great about where they are right now if I were Democratic camp. I mean, it's going to be a close race no matter what, but when you're putting out press releases, as I think they did yesterday, that are sort of, dunking on, President Biden's fundraising numbers relative to President Trump, like, okay, but that's not the scoreboard on which, elections are won or lost.
I definitely want to get into those fundraising numbers, but one thing I just want to, can I just point out something quickly about this is, you mentioned the fact that they wanted to roll him out there just to prove that he could do it. And that, I think, was really, when it came to the media reaction and the partisan reaction, that's actually what they were responding to.
That's it. Yeah, you hit it on the head. So you said at the top of it that 300 million Americans didn't watch the speech, and it's the people who watch the speech are the Beltway crew and kind of boomers and political junkies and
sick people who fall asleep.
Exactly. People in waiting rooms at assisted care homes, at doctor's offices, whatever. Urgent cares. But, so absolutely, the thing that the press was grading Biden on, the thing that the speech, I think, did accomplish is that he had a pulse. He was angry, he was loud, and he didn't have just some, aphasic or, fugue state moment in the middle of the speech where he started wandering away from the lectern. And on that score, don't forget, a couple weeks before the speech was the fever pitch highest. Of the, is Biden up to this? Maybe he should pull out. What are our emergency plans?
In response narrative. To the release of the HER report, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so on, what I think the speech did accomplish was shoring up the kind of, or plugging the dam of the media, drumbeat on his, competence and sort of stopping that news cycle from growing any larger. Now, it didn't do anything to change, I don't think, even as partisan as it was, it didn't do anything to change sort of like the voters that he has the most problems with, which, John just identified one big block, the kind of Hamas first crowd, and just young people in general, right? But Biden has a whole other playbook he does very, very, very cynically to appease those voters, which is that he does sort of like unworkable, extra legal shit that are, handouts to them and their either handouts to them or that flatter their insane and completely unrealistic, ideological commitments, like, the several waves of student loan, debt relief, And even just the other day, like the EPA rule that's, that's like an outlaw, the internal combustion cars in 5 minutes, that's just completely unworkable, but it's obviously a desperate, sop to, the kind of younger idealistic progressives who never loved Biden. And he's just desperate to do whatever it takes to win them over, even if it means, cutting off the Israelis, when they're 80, 85, 90% of the way home in their war against Hamas. He's got a whole other playbook to appease those guys. Or to try to anyway. So I think the speech, was more about those functionaries, the whispering class, the DC class, the media. And on that score, graded on that very steep curve, I think there was some good to it for him.
So one thing I did want to bring up before we move to the fundraising numbers is, I think one of the things that we're going to see in response to the sort of cognitive questions that the HER report obviously just took to a new level, and I don't know if you've read the report. I am considering hiring a friend to do a dramatic reading of one answer to a question from Robert Herr that goes on for 7 pages, it's just kind of a classic old man, telling an onion in the belt story. But the thing that is, there's a Washington Post piece from Matt Visor today. Biden's stutter surges into the presidential campaign, they have a quote from Jason Miller, an advisor to former President Trump. Who says that the president, the former president, is just mocking Biden for being cognitively impaired? Advisor writes in response, "There is no evidence that Biden is cognitively impaired." And to me, that's something that actually the inability to admit anything like that is going to become more and more laughable as this campaign goes on. Just saying that, like, hey, with age, you run into just different challenges, and that's just natural, and that, it's something that lots of Americans are familiar with, but he's perfectly capable of doing the job, is a more reasonable response than basically pretending, oh, this is just because of his childhood stutter. I say this, by the way, as someone who had a significant speech defect well into my life, and really only overcame it fully when I was about 9 or 10, and that's something that I think is I don't know, it's just a level of spin that I think we have to anticipate is going to be all the more intense as things go forward, and as frankly, the president is incapable of sustaining that kind of high energy performance that we saw in the State of the Union on a daily basis. In fact, quite the opposite.
Well, it just that headline. The headline. What was it? Stutter surges into the presidential
Surges
race.
into the
Yeah,
presidential campaign.
it reminds me of a great old Onion headline from their book of 20th century headlines about Stalin's death, and it was Stalin suffers from, or no, maybe it was Lenin. It was Lenin suffers from glorious stroke of the people. Like a lack of oxygen equally distributed throughout brain, like just the idea that you're like trying to turn this somehow into a
Well,
heroic
let's look at the
factor.
bright side, So, but let's talk about those fundraising numbers, John. His advantage is quite clear. The campaign account took in $21 million for the Democrats in February, ending the month with $71 million cash on hand. That combines to more than 97.5 million cash on hand as of the end of February for the Biden campaign and the DNC. That's more than double what the RNC and the Trump campaign have. They're at about 44, 45 million. Does this matter? How much does this cash gap matter? Particularly given the fact that the former president is so distracted by all of his legal challenges, and by requirements in terms of court appearances and limitations on his ability to travel and to fundraise, and quite frankly, the fact that they just did this went through this ditching of Ronna McDaniel that leads to a whole new fundraising operation, and the fact that this is preceded by the assassination of one Kevin McCarthy, their longtime best fundraiser in terms of the House side, at least. This seems to put the Republicans really in a position where they're behind the eight ball and going to be outspent by a dramatic amount. How much does this matter?
It's a good question. And as a guy that doesn't really come from a campaign background, it's harder for me to make a more definitive or educated statement, which isn't going to stop me from giving just sort of my general observation. I think it's probably more harmful for congressional Republicans. And I haven't really seen a look at where the fundraising numbers are, particularly in the Senate, where I think that Republicans are really on the goal line and it's first and goal to go. And you know, with you know, Manchin's retirement, I mean, I think that seat flips and you know, they really need, I mean, things would have to go really, really wrong for them not to flip the Senate, though I think that they do need to pad their margin when you look at upcoming maps. The bigger concern is probably the House, where the DCCC, you know, is continuing to outraise. The NRCC, I think, you know, as you mentioned, look, I think at some point, you know, if he's able to hang on, you know, I think Speaker Johnson, like every Republican speaker, will eventually outraise, you know, the last one. But to do that midstream, where, you know, a lot of dollars are being sucked up by the presidential campaign to play, you know, President Trump's legal fees, I think that that becomes more problematic. For the Senate guys, I just think that presidential outcomes are so correlated at this point with down ballot Senate. So take Ohio. And, you know, obviously Bernie Moreno, who just won that primary, newer to the political scene. We don't know what stories may come out, you know, one way or the other about him. But, you know, if you expect that President Trump, which a lot of pundits do, is going to win by high single digits or more, you know, we'll say 8 points. I think that's about what he won by Trump in 20. It's hard for me to believe, as talented as I think Sherrod Brown is, that he is able to do 8 points better than Joe Biden in Ohio against a at least replacement level Republican. So I think if you're stepping back to look at the presidential, the question is, what are you doing with that money? I mean, both of these candidates, their name ID is probably about 100%. Everyone has a formed opinion of both of them. You can probably, you know, and I think that Harry Enten at CNN had a really good article just looking at the state of the race that was from a couple of weeks ago, but I think it holds up pretty well. Of, you know, even if Biden's best path at this point is probably to accentuate Trump's negatives relative to his own, but I mean, you're going to run ads saying that President Trump is, you know, not a great citizen or that kind of stuff. Like, I think that's all kind of baked in, right? I mean, it feels like, during the California recall, you know, when Arnold became governor of, you know, this, you know, the October surprise was that, you know, Arnold, you know, had some sort of affair or something. And everyone was like, of course he did. You know, he's this like, you know, roided up Hollywood guy. Like, sure. I mean, it was already kind of priced into the political stock of those guys. You know, does the grassroots stuff matter? Does it turn out more votes? Probably. You'd probably just want, you know, you probably want to make sure you leave it all out on the field. But I don't know. Like, what do you guys think? I just you'd rather have more money than not, but I don't know that it's conclusive.
Yeah. Well, this is the guy. Trump is the guy who proved that money in presidential politics doesn't matter if, and it's a very big if, you have $3 quadrillion worth of earned media for the entirety of, you know, since the moment you walk down the escalator, right? So Trump got outspent in 2016 handily by Hillary and won a big electoral college win. And so I don't think it matters. I'm with you, John, in a sense. I don't think it really matters for Trump. There's all sorts of ancillary reasons why it matters. One is, of course, down ballot races. A big one for me is just what it says about the kinds of people who Trump brings out to vote. And, you know, this is a problem that the MAGA crowd has over and over and over again, which is that, you know, on the one hand, they want to say you need Trump on the ballot if you want to win. But and that might be true, given the current makeup of the electorate and the Republican Party. But they forget the flip side of that, which is that, you know, those voters are not Republican voters. Those voters are Trump voters. And so you obviously see these massive problems in the midterms where Trump isn't on the ballot, whether he's in office or not. He suffered, you know, in the midterms for just being a presence and for not being on the ballot. And you also see it in kind of marginal, you know, in kind of marginal races that, you know, Republicans could win. Like John, you were talking about in a place like Ohio or, you know, wherever you expect Trump to run up big numbers, you know, he'll be able to pull up even mediocre candidates. But the problem with that is that those voters that he turns out, those low propensity voters, and we've talked a lot about how the parties have switched on that, that low propensity voters are now Republican voters. You know, they're not the kind of people who write checks to the RNC. Insofar as they're giving small dollar donations or money to Trump, it's to buy the solid gold sneakers or, you know, whatever, a set of commemorative Trump NASCAR plates or whatever merch he's selling or another MyPillow, whatever it is. And those guys, you know, are not committed to the success of the Republican Party. They're not committed to the success of their congressional candidates. They're not really committed to policy victories in any recognizable sense. What they're committed to is the pay-per-view event that is Donald Trump, and they will pay, like, the, you know, they'll pay for the next UFC fight to, you know, keep Trump on the scene to entertain them, and they'll show up and vote for him when his name is on the ballot. But they can't be counted on to, you know, maintain the infrastructure of a big complicated thing like a political party. So I do think that's a problem for the long term. And I do think that the solutions that and rationalizations that the kind of instrumentalist MAGA crowd has come up with are very short-sighted, and that they won't outlive Trump and Trump's presence in public life. So I do think it's a big problem for him. I mean, the small dollar donations are disastrous, I think. And there is something there, but again, I don't know that translates into, oh, Trump can't compete with Biden for all the familiar reasons. Like, he obviously is competing, and he doesn't need more name recognition, and he's probably going to win and all those things. But there's definitely deep structural rot that is reflected in the fact that nobody seems interested in giving the RNC a dollar. And who can blame them? I mean, given how badly it's been run recently and how poor the results were for them.
You know, one thing I do want to point out about the, you know, sort of the issues here is that I think that Trump can, I agree with you, John. I think that Trump can overcome that Trump can overcome the lack of funding in a way that perhaps down ballot people cannot. But, you know, it is really a question of if you have those resources, where do you spend them and how do you spend them? And to me, the big question is whether the RNC under this new leadership, which includes, of course, Laura Trump, is going to do something silly, like try to spend to expand the map, as opposed to focus on the six or seven states that they actually need to win the presidency. Because you can't really rebuild the husk that is left of the RNC in time to have it have an effect in this election. But what you can do is, I think, focus the resources that you have on the six or seven states that you need in order to win, and then deal with that afterwards. And I think that's going to be kind of the decision point personally.
Well, it's helpful that those states to some degree align with, you know, I think some of them are more reaches, but, you know, take a look at Michigan, right? Where I think Trump is slightly ahead right now. And in a neutral environment, you'd say that Alyssa Slotkin, the sitting Democratic congresswoman, is favored, right? She's, you know, relatively, you know, more middle of the road for a Democrat. She's, you know, she's not objectionable. She's not, you know, part of the squad or anything like that. But, you know, depending on who Republicans nominate, and I think if it's a guy like, you know, Mike, former congressman, former, you know, Intelligence Committee Chairman, former, you know, FBI agent Mike Rogers, that if Trump wins Michigan with 52%, like, I think Mike Rogers could get pulled across the finish line at that point. Wisconsin maybe a little bit tougher, you know, since Tammy Baldwin is a sitting senator, but I mean, it's just I think the map works for Republicans really well, at least in the Senate this year. I think the House is going to be, you know, a lot trickier, but look, Republicans still managed to dodge somewhat a bullet in New York. where the map got worse, but nowhere near as bad as I think a lot of folks expected it to for the House, you know, districts. And I think it's going to come down to candidate quality, just like it did in 22.
So
one other thing where money, sorry, real quick, where money might matter and it's compounded is just early voting, mail-in voting, get out the vote, everything related to getting voters to ballots.
Well, you've anticipated the next thing I wanted to talk about. So Trump has rolled out a new slogan that appeared behind him on signs, printed on signs in the past couple of weeks, too big to rig. It, you know, brings to mind that old, you know, if it's not close, they can't cheat slogan that used to be used. And it, the idea is that, you know, well, we just need to swamp them and then it's not going to matter. But the problem is this, he continues to undermine early voting, mail-in ballot efforts as being something that is inherently corrupt or corrupting. You know, he said, you know, if you have mail-in voting, you automatically have fraud. You know, as recently as I was in the room when he said that in South Carolina. And, you know, we've seen time and again that Democrats have made more use of these mail-in and early ballots than Republicans have. But it's something that I think is going to prove to be you know, a real issue only if it's something that, you know, really Republican voters respond to, as opposed to basically saying, okay, well, I agree that there's problems with that, this, that, and the other, but I still, you know, want to participate. Is this something that can be overcome? Do you think that Trump can change his messaging on this to some degree, or is he so locked in on this and obsessed with it that he's going to be dissing these efforts, even as the RNC and other entities are trying to convince, you know, state parties, et cetera, are trying to convince their voters that, yes, you should do this because it's something that will help us bank votes and not require you to make it to the polls.
I see it as 50-50. He's going to need to change his tune if he wants to win. It's going to be too close, and it's going to be something that needs to happen. But it's funny with Trump, you always wonder whether he is saying something that he knows isn't true, or whether he's, you know, George Costanza style, it's not a lie if you believe it. And I think the early voting one has to be in, and the mail-in voting has to be in the latter category. There's just no other explanation for his level of dedication. I think the classic, you know, the narrative of how Trump views this, the sort of model, mental model of how he views it, is that he watches his numbers go up on election night, and he watches himself get ahead in all these states, and then he sees big batches of mail-in votes come in, and he watches his lead disappear. And I think that level of kind of linear causal thinking is a very comfortable mode for Donald Trump to be in. And as a result, I think he believes his own bullshit on this question. So I think he's too, you know, you put it, locked in. I do think that he is absolutely committed to this, and I don't think he's just saying it cynically because it's an excuse for why he lost to Joe Biden in 2020. He's got plenty of those, and I think there are plenty of things he does say around the election that he doesn't necessarily believe or doesn't really care whether they're true one way or another. But I actually think in the case of non-in-person, non-election day voting, he does believe it, and that's going to be a huge, huge, huge problem for them to overcome. I'm not sure they can.
Yeah, you sort of stole my thunder there, Dan, because I was going to say almost the exact same thing. I think that the concept of early voting or mail-in voting, I think going back to the first few years of the Trump presidency, there were two things I think you could comfortably say that he truly, well and truly believed and had been saying consistently those things for a long time. One of which is that trade or bad trade, you know, bad deals were bad, and that sort of the U.S. immigration system was bad. Consistently said those things. He seems to actually and truly believe them. I think this is another, the voting, the early vote, mail-in vote, seems to me to be maybe the third thing in that set of things you can say he is absolutely locked in and really truly does believe it, that it's bad. I don't know. I mean, some of his senior campaign hands are smart people. You know, they should understand that this is going to set him back somewhat, especially when you're talking about, you know, low propensity voters. It's a lot easier when you've got a couple weeks or a month to try to make sure they're voting, as opposed to a single day to do that. The Democrats are going to do it. I mean, there's no evidence that it leads to anything, systemic or election changing. So I don't know. I mean, it looked like Glenn Youngkin was able in Virginia to, and maybe it'll, I guess the question is sort of the old Republican Party, the more, that was more dominated by, college educated suburbanites, are enough of them able to get over the hump on voting for Trump as just, the Republican, and are still willing to do that? I think Brian Kemp was talking about, some of the early and mail-in kind of stuff down in Georgia. I think there's certainly ways to do this that have had some success, but maybe it depends on having a state where you essentially have one or two really big metros with, a lot of, college educated voters that are willing to do that. I'm not really sure, but I think that, that sets the Trump campaign way back to, where you're essentially going into election day, millions of votes behind, and you've got to, clean all that up on one day. And so if you're able to do it over a period of time.
The one of the questions before we wrap things up that I think we do have to wrestle with is the question of, whether this is going to be a campaign that plays out basically as we see it today, meaning a kind of predictable slog of that's going to focus on the issue set as it currently stands, meaning immigration, economy, abortion on the Democrat side, the crime issue on the Republican side, and that kind of thing, or whether that you think that there's going to be some kind of shift. It seemed plausible, I think, a couple of months ago, especially in the wake of the October 7th attacks, that this would be an election where foreign policy would matter a lot more than it normally does in a presidential election. There's basically been one foreign policy, maybe election, in my lifetime in 04. And, in 08, it could have been one, but then you had the financial crisis, which superseded it. It's very possible that I think, there are different things that can happen that can, come in and randomly shift or change the direction of things. But that to me is a question that you can always kind of look at in the spring and say, is this going to be a set election, or is this going to be one where there's going to be some kind of wild card? If it's a set election, who benefits? If this is a wild card election, who benefits?
A couple things. I think in a weird way, not in a weird way, I think in subtle ways, it is a foreign policy election, because we obviously just talked about the little delicate dance that Biden is trying to do. I think doing it terribly, by the way, like, especially this stuff about Rafa, and, we don't have to get into actually the conduct of the war, but like just making awful calculated decisions that please nobody and probably make his position worse. Like, they're executing it terribly, but that's a relevant issue. And I mean, I think John was right when he said earlier that there's way more, certainly Jewish voters, but also just generally pro-Israel voters in the Democratic coalition that you're going to alienate by trying to grab 500,000 votes, wherever in New Jersey and Michigan and a couple other places, where there are, dense populations of Arab Americans. But, leave that to one side. That is one issue that I do think is weighing on Biden's ceiling. Now, I don't think Trump has any real advantages there necessarily. I mean, certainly, even a guy like me who doesn't, not a fan of President Trump, has to say his Middle East policy was sort of almost accidentally, in some cases, quite successful. But anyway, so that's one way in which it is. I'll give you another way in which it is. And we've talked about this, I think, just for a minute here or there on the podcast, but we've certainly talked about it amongst ourselves offline, is, there were just more numbers yesterday. Some pretty big survey came out on military service numbers, and particularly this time they asked families, military families, whether they would recommend that their children go into the service, and the numbers were absolutely awful and incredibly awful, and I think in a way that's going to have, frankly, earth-shattering repercussions for decades to come, and it happening at precisely the worst moment. And You know, I tweeted about this or X'd about it or whatever, and I got a lot, a ton of responses, and a lot from, you know, people said that, and now this is anecdotal, admittedly, but a lot of people echoing what the survey said, you know, said that for them it was about Afghanistan, and it was about just the sense that there was nobody at home, you know, thinking through these things, and that they had zero trust in their leadership. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily, it wasn't a, you know, a kind, I wasn't getting like a ton of isolationism. It was more like, if Washington doesn't believe in the mission and they haven't thought it through, like, why should I put myself or my family or my kids' lives on the line? So anyway, I think stuff like that exists in the background that is a part of the election. Now, as far as static versus, you know, dynamic, I will quote one of your guys's favorite guys. We'll call him a frenemy of the show because he's an old pal of mine. But I like what Jonah Goldberg says about this, is that he thinks it's going to be a late night Japanese game show election, meaning just you're going to have no idea what's going to happen minute to minute.
I
And
don't
I think,
speak Japanese.
yeah, exactly. We're all going to be Chris Farley, you know, in the SNL sketch. So I think it's much more likely to be completely wild that way. I mean, in 2020, we obviously had right around, oh, yesterday, the day before we're filming this podcast, recording this podcast, like we had, you know, COVID become a thing, and that, you know, messed things up a little bit. So I'm sure there are going to be wild cards, and I think the wild cards, it really obviously just depends on, you know, which way they cut, who it's going to benefit. A static election, yeah, a static election, I think, is set, you know, I think it's a narrow Trump win. If you put a gun to my head, I think, you know, that's where we're headed.
Yeah, I would agree again. And I tend to think this, at least right now, is going to look probably more like a static election. To me, the analogy I've been thinking of as we've been talking really is if the 2016 race really for Trump, right? And we've talked before about the more joyous, fun Trump of 2016, that was Rocky one, right? This plucky challenger who comes out of nowhere, realizing that Rocky lost to Apollo, but more than covered the spread in the fight. Biden Trump 24 is like the end of Rocky two, where these guys can't even see each other, and they're just sort of feeling around with their boxing gloves in the ring, just trying to find the guy to be able to take a swing at him. That's really going to be an endurance thing for these guys. Neither of whom are young men. Or neither of whom are probably pictures of perfect health at this point. I've had multiple people just in my life generally that aren't necessarily political people ask about what's the chance that there's a reason, a health reason, why one of these guys is not able to be on the ballot in November. And I think it's, at this point, it seems, likely that they both will be, but it's not a trivial question at this point. And I think that could probably be more likely sort of the wild card. I don't. With regard to foreign policy, at least in our sort of professional lifetimes, I think that really 2002 is probably the only time. I do think you get some of the sort of the malaise kind of stuff that happened, like we saw in 06 when things in Iraq weren't going well. But I think 2002 was really the one true foreign policy election. But even there, it was things that were happening here, right? It was post 9/11. Where Americans died on American soil. I just don't think that foreign policy, other than sort of broad strokes, really moves the needle for people. And I think that, again, going back to that end piece, if this election is about the economy and it's about immigration, if you're Donald Trump, I mean, this thing, those are pitches that are you can see coming right over the middle of the plate. And they're
Yeah.
ones where you've seen, the Bidenomics flop. Set aside the policies, just the whole branding flop. The immigration thing where he's tried, where President Biden has tried to, become, somewhat more hawkish. I agree. I think that the greatest danger that Trump had, which I'm not even sure how much of a danger it was, which would have been a pre-election conviction on one of the legal cases. All those things seem like that, they're going to get kind of punted. And even if they were to occur, like, will they really matter to his voters? So I think this is going to be, this is going to look like a Harry Reid or a Mitch McConnell re-election, where you're just trying to raise the negatives of the other guy. And certainly, large parts of America don't like either one. And among those voters, that think they're both bad, like who do they vote for? I think that that's going to be kind of the elemental question of this election.
Well, I want to go out on this. I don't know if you've all been paying attention to the situation regarding the Truth Social stock. Have either of you been paying attention to this?
I have
no, but
not.
My broker keeps me updated regularly.
So the Digital World Acquisition, which is the SPAC that is you know behind a Truth Social, so it Truth Social is very obviously not a good product. Like it has struggled to work. It doesn't really. It burned through all of its initial like 40 mil in cash that was backing it. You know, it's not a good product, but all of these investors over the past several months have been boosting the stock basically in response to Trump's political performance. So basically the more better that he does politically, the more the stock goes up. There's supposed to be a vote tomorrow, Friday, but we're recording on Thursday, about whether to take the company public. And the Wall Street Journal reports that should they do so, Trump's shares in the company would amount to being worth $3.5 billion.
It's going to go. I wonder how that vote's going to go.
I just think this is, I mean, it's hilarious on some level. It's like, I mean, the idea that this is an actual company as opposed to just like people boosting a meme stock. Trump becoming a meme stock is kind of the perfect way to a perfect denouement to his story. Like they're going to seize 454, you know, whatever the, you know, he doesn't have the cash to pay off the amount necessary. I don't know what it's at interest, right, as we're recording, to prevent Letitia James from seizing all his properties, but then to like sell his stock or, you know, find some other way to do a deal for the value related to it in order to buy it back. That is just a perfect end to the Trump financial woes, you know, and everything related to it. We all made fun of the NFTs. We all made fun of all this other, you know, stuff. And yet, essentially, at the end of the day, this valueless company could be the key that actually bails him out. Maybe we're the dumb ones. Maybe we're the ones who don't know what we're talking about when it comes to actually making money, if this is the way that you can make money in America today.
Well, so there's so much there, but I think GameStop and AMC and the meme stocks were, and Dogecoin or whatever you want to throw in there, and Bored Ape, they're one phenomenon with the Trump phenomenon. They're examples, they're instances of the same dynamics that are made possible by a world that's kind of, you know, by a reality that's kind of shaped by virtual reality, not to get too sophomore dorm room, you know, like, but they're all, you know, they're all functions of, you know, social media, what it does, the sort of information bubbles it creates, the coordination, massive coordination it makes possible. You know, they called the meme stock investors dumb money, but to your point, the dumb money persisted for long enough, and there was enough of it that, you know, this quote unquote smart guys, you know, suffered in the end. Now, I'm enough of a capitalist and a free market guy to believe that on a long enough timeline, markets are rational. But as I think it was, as Greenspan said, you know, markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. Right. And that's the thing that, you know, that faces us all. And I do, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if whatever happened with True Social wouldn't surprise me if it was, you know, the greatest scam in history, if an IPO crashed, it utterly crashed and burned and was humiliating, wouldn't surprise me. Wouldn't surprise me if he raised the $3.5 billion. You know, I think these dynamics are so hard to get your arms around when you're dealing with flash mobs that can be created by social media posts and appear as quickly as they disappear. You know, no outcome would surprise me.
Well, I think that when you combine that with the fact that Steve Mnuchin is now looking into buying TikTok, it would really be, it's a real, like, you know, Revenge of the Empire kind of, you know, end to this whole sort of saga.
So, yes, I think that that's I think that's a good way to look at it. It's just you have sort of these things that get denounced as being ridiculous and stupid and silly. And then it turns out that they're more valuable than things that people that, you know, actually have more sustainable value in the long term because we are people who chase memes and the like. Well, this has been Thunderdome, and we're going to take a break here, I think, you know, in terms of this format for a while. Perhaps we'll come back around the conventions and then perhaps around the debates, because, you know, we anticipate that a lot of this over the next couple of months is going to be about Lawfare and the like. As always, I recommend that you subscribe to The Spectator. You can head over to thespectator.com, sign up for our digital only or print and digital subscriptions. It's a great magazine, and I really hope that you'll check it out. I have a couple articles in the latest edition, one on the media's failure and one on the fight over foreign policy on the right. And so I hope that you'll do that. For Dan, for John, I'm Ben Domenech, and you've been listening to the latest edition of Thunderdome. We will be back in the future with more to guide you through this crazy 2024 election.